Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with an argument that President Obama should go to Congress to make his case for war against Syria. Award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic, James Fellows, joins us to discuss his article at The Atlantic, "Here's a Wild Idea About Syria, Make the Case to Congress," and that there is more on the line than a president's credibility when it comes to war. Then we'll look into what is happening at the UN as a repeat of the Iraq experience appears to be underway, with calls to allow UN weapons inspectors time to do their job before the bombing begins. Barbara Cassette, the UN correspondent for The Nation and the former New York Times bureau chief at the UN, joins us to discuss efforts by the British to draft a resolution based on the R2P doctrine, the responsibility to protect, that would allow military action in Syria based on humanitarian grounds that civilians need to be protected from the regime's use of WMDs. Then finally, we'll speak with Colonel Andrew Bacevich, a retired U.S. Army colonel who is currently a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. We will discuss his article at BillMoyers.com, Questions for President Obama Before He Pulls the Trigger, and the reality that only 9% of Americans support a war against Syria, as well as the fact that from a soldier's perspective, war is a risky business. And joining us now is James Fellow, who is an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate, and he's also the former editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest book is China Airborne. He has an article at The Atlantic, Here's a Wild Idea About Syria, Make the Case to Congress. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Fellows.
Ian, it's nice to talk to you again.
And your wild idea, of course, is how business was done for most of the, 200-plus years of the Republic. But it certainly has not been the convention of late, has it?
It has not been. And you can understand one practical reason why presidents have not gone to Congress, which is there are certain circumstances that are so fast-breaking, et cetera, that the executive needs the ability to respond quickly. But I think when there is a well-advertised, coldly calculated, punitive, as we're hearing it, strike being contemplated, then I think there is both democratic and political advantage and compelling advantage for President Obama to involve the Congress rather than just doing this himself.
Well, of course, the British have done exactly that. Now, maybe now Cameron regrets doing it because he got quite a backlash. And Jack Straw, the architect of the Iraq War, not the architect of the Iraq, but the foreign minister during the Iraq War with Tony Blair, has voiced his reservations. And now they're going to have another vote because the parliament said basically we're not going to vote on this until the evidence is in from the UN, and that won't be completed until Saturday. That seems to be, in terms of this red line, it does seem that nothing's going to happen until Saturday.
It is so strange that we're talking in these sort of hourly or daily predictions about impending military action, both in terms of the traditional military concept, if you're going to do something, you do it by surprise, and in terms of the democratic concept that we're just assuming something happening without a full contemplation by the political process. I think the British, the UK example shows both why President Obama is avoiding going to Congress, but also why he should go to Congress. And now I'll just spend 30 seconds laying out that scenario. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that the U.S., the Britain, the French, whatever, feel they need to enforce this so-called red line against chemical weapons use, and that the punitive raids work better than any other military actions in history. Even if they work extremely well, there are going to be things that go wrong. There will be innocent people who die. There will be collateral damage. There are things that no one foresees. Recall that the U.S. mistakenly bombed the Chinese embassy in the Balkans during a similar campaign in 1999 to over Kosovo. And so it is in the political interest of the regimes in both countries, both the Cameron government in the UK and the Obama administration here, to get some to share the political responsibility for what is what may be a success, but has a lot of will certainly have some unwholesome aspects too. Also, as a matter of democracies, democracies are supposed to decide democratically on acts of war. So I think it is good for the country and also good for both Barack Obama and David Cameron to involve the political process in this decision.
And James Follows, so much in international relations has been driven by leaders' sense of their own credibility. You recall Henry Kissinger's reluctance to end the war in Vietnam, even though it was a manifest failure, because our credibility was shot, and that the Russians would suddenly think, or the Soviets would suddenly not take us seriously, which of course was ridiculous because they were enjoying the fact that we were wasting our lives and treasure, and we paid them back by when they got embroiled in Afghanistan. So I don't understand how leaders equate their own credibility with a nation's need to go to war.
I agree with you on this, and I think this is probably it's one of the two or three parallel strands we need to address here. One of those strands is whether, entirely apart from what Barack Obama said last year about the red line involving chemical weapons, whether there is a shared international interest in defending the so-called norm against the use of chemical weapons. I personally disagree with the argument that it's worth getting involved in Syria for that reason, but that is one part of it. The second and different strand is the idea that precisely because Barack Obama said there is this red line, and only because he said that, therefore the U.S. is required to make good on that threat, otherwise it will look like some kind of hollow figure on the world stage. My observation of political history and world history is that credibility in the long run depends on demonstrating a clear-eyed, long-term view of your rational interests and your rational ideals, and not defending something just because you got backed into a corner for it. I think that makes you look weak and outmaneuvered rather than credible. And I don't think, for example, the continuation of the bombing campaign in Vietnam long ago did anything to enhance U.S. credibility. So if President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron really believe that for interests of world peace and nonproliferation in the long run, they must attack Syria, that's one thing. If they're doing this just because President Obama drew this line, then I think that is foolish, and I hope that is not the grounds for going ahead.
And again, I'm speaking with James Follows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate, and he's the former editor of U.S. News and World Report. And his books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest book is China Airborne. He has an article at The Atlantic, Here's a Wild Idea About Syria, Make the Case to Congress. Now, in terms of the UN, it does seem, James Follows, that the British are trying to lead the way in crafting a resolution to present to a paralyzed UN Security Council, where Russia and China routinely veto any resolutions to punish Assad. So that is a given, but there is this concept and doctrine called R2P, responsibility to protect, and that seems to be the rubric under which the British are floating their resolution. So what do you think? I mean, the latest rumors coming out of the White House is that they're planning to do a shot across the bow. So they seem to want to separate the Syrian war from but you can understand that mental slip. They want to separate the Syrian war from the need to punish Syria for the crossing the line on WMD. So what's your sense of not just addressing Congress, but also what Samantha Power and Susan Rice, both of who are big proponents of R2P, should be doing?
Again, first we should say nobody knows what is going to happen. It's possible that all of the rumors we're hearing out of London, Washington, are being very deliberately, but not they're being deliberately leaked in our smokescreen operations. So we don't know that. We do pretty much know that the UN Security Council will not approve any action on Syria because of the different interests of both Russia and China. China, with its doctrine of non-intervention, Russia as an effective ally of Syria. I think I think the administration in the U.S. is in an awkward position presenting either of these cases. If it's making the obligation to protect, requirement to protect case, then the question is, well, what about the last year in which 100,000 people or so were killed? And where does this responsibility end, et cetera, et cetera? So it would be strange to advance that argument only now, when several hundreds of people as opposed to tens of thousands have been killed. On the punitive grounds, saying that there is a norm, there have to be consequences for crossing this line, there is by definition no rush about inflicting that penalty. It's not a time-sensitive thing, and so I think the burden, the advantage would be on the U.S. both to make the case to its own political leadership and to make the case internationally, saying we recognize the United Nations is paralyzed here, it disagrees. We, in our capacities as Western nations, believe there's something we have to do, and so this is the case. You know, I disagree with that, but I think the most effective way to proceed would be to explain why the United Nations can't work and say, this is exactly what we're doing, why we're doing it. And then there's one other complication I will filibuster on about here. There is a very difficult middle ground the administration in the U.S. is trying to occupy. On the one hand, it wants to do something that is not so trivial that it has no effect at all. On the other hand, it doesn't want to do something that is so large then just ensures retaliation, further U.S. engagement, et cetera. So that middle ground between something strong enough that Assad notices and pays a price and small enough that he doesn't respond in some escalating way, that may be a very, very small territory to occupy.
So, James Fellows, the last time any president went to Congress in advance of a war was George H.W. Bush in advance of the first Gulf War, where he sought approval and got it. There are similar circumstances in as much as an unsavory dictator had crossed the line and invaded a country. And I'm sure the president could make the case that another unsavory dictator has crossed the line to the Congress. Given the gridlock there in Washington, just him showing up at Congress, to my mind, wouldn't be a bad idea, let alone getting this resolution.
I agree. And actually, there is one more unsettling example, which is that after the 9/11 attacks, actually, George W. Bush did get from Congress the so-called authorization for use of military force, which has essentially been the blanket for everything that has happened thereafter. And Obama himself has pointed out that this is too sweeping. We have to get out of this era of open-ended war. But I think that given Obama's history, his political history of talking about the proper constitutional balance, his personal history as a constitutional lawyer, his political situation now as somebody who is criticized both on the right and the left for the endless expansion of executive power, I think it would be in his enlightened self-interest and that of the country for him formally to make a case as opposed to just going on TV and saying, as I speak, bombs are dropping.
So what are the chances then? I mean, what do you hear? You're there in Washington with your ear to the ground. I mean, one of the things I find extraordinary about this is that, you know, Putin has been very silent on this, but the U.S. and Russia really do have a common interest here in Syria, which is neither country wants al-Qaeda to take over. And the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front seems to be the most effective military force on the rebel side. And if you empower them and they take over, that's a nightmare for the U.S. And the Russians also share that nightmare, with the Caucasus only being 500 miles away. So I'm just surprised that there's not more common interest here in making this peace conference work, given that the intractable nature of the two sides.
Everything you say makes sense to me, and so this is one of many imponderables. And I find myself unable to predict with any confidence what's going to happen. Certainly over the last 20 years, you would think this kind of buildup in Washington would virtually ensure a military action. I'm struck this time that over the past week there's been more resistance than I would have expected. You know, usually it's the case that all of these serious figures in the press are making pro-military arguments because just by definition they seem more legitimate and grown up. There's been from the Congress, from both parties, from people in, you know, both each of the parties is split on this. The Republicans have their neocon and libertarian type factions. The Democrats have their liberal hawk and non-liberal hawk faction. So there's been more resistance than I expected, and I just don't know what we'll be seeing a week's time from now.
Well, I think what's underlying that reality is a poll that says only 9% of the United of the people in this country want to go to war in Syria.
Yes.
That's pretty extraordinary.
And that, you could say that a country that over the last 12 years has been sapped and economically, physically, in many other ways by essentially endless war, that there is at least the check in the democratic system to say, do we need another one?
Well, James Fellows, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Fellows. He's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. He's also a former editor of U.S. News and World Report, and his books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest book is China Airborne. He also has an article at The Atlantic, Here's a Wild Idea About Syria, Make the Case to Congress. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into what is happening at the UN. So